Hello, my name is Elizabeth Ingber with the Talking Information Center. This is the Thursday, April 9th, 2026 edition of USA Today. Elections. GOP wins with smaller margins in Marjorie Taylor Greene's old Georgia seat. Democrats came up short in Georgia's 14th congressional district, but the forecasted blue wave eroded previous MAGA-fueled wins in the area, by Philip M. Bailey. Republican Clay Fuller prevailed over Democrat Sean Harris in Georgia's special election for Congress on April 7th, but a growing blue wave eroded the wide 2024 GOP margins in the district set by President Donald Trump and former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. The race was called by the Associated Press and NBC News less than 90 minutes after the polls closed. The contest to replace Greene, who resigned in January after a falling out with Trump, was widely watched for signs of fractures in the Make America Great Again movement and the size of the rising political tide for Democrats ahead of the 2026 midterms. Fuller, a former prosecutor, was endorsed by Trump. Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, and other Republican leaders cheered the win, which adds a needed member to the slim House majority. In Congress, Clay will be a strong ally of President Trump and help House Republicans grow the economy, secure the border, and keep Americans safe. Representative Richard Hudson, Republican of North Carolina, chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, said in a statement, "A swing away from GOP in a red district." Fuller scored decisive wins in most of the 10 counties in Georgia's 14th congressional district, which stretches across northwestern Georgia from the Atlanta suburbs to the Tennessee border. Fuller's lead hovered around 16 percentage points, with 92% of the votes counted. That represents a 21-point swing away from the GOP compared to the last presidential election, when Trump won by roughly 37 percentage points in 2024. No Democrat has ever received more than 40% of the vote in the district. Harris, a 60-year-old cattle farmer and retired Army Brigadier General, opposed the Iran war, calling it a war of choice by the president that needed more oversight from Congress. "This was not the result we wanted, but the message is clear. People here are ready for leadership that puts them first," Harris said in a post on X shortly after the results. Democrats nationally were more focused on the margins than the final results coming out of the district, which is one of the more MAGA-friendly areas in the country. In deeply red Chautauqua County, for instance, which is right at the border with Alabama, Fuller won by approximately 40 percentage points, according to preliminary numbers. Greene had bested Harris 2 years ago by about 52 percentage points. Former U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who came to the district in support of Harris's underdog campaign, said while the Democratic candidate came up short, he generated excitement in a district few thought possible until recently. "Across the country, in very different corners of America, I see forms of this same energy mounting," Buttigieg, a rumored 2028 presidential contender, said in an April 7th post on X. "If we keep working hard, unbelievable results will be possible in November." Canada. Kit Kat trucks get security escort after overseas heist, by Melina Khan. Kit Kat is playing it safe after last month's massive heist of thousands of its candy bars overseas. The Canadian branch of the chocolate maker deployed security details to protect its deliveries during Easter weekend, according to a news release. Kit Kat Canada said it opted to heighten safety measures with security escorts for delivery trucks and guards for in-store monitoring over the busy restocking weekend. While some may find this disruptive to their day, we think it's necessary security measures to ensure our wafer bars make it to retail safely, the company said. Last month, KitKat announced thieves in Europe stole an entire truck containing more than 400,000, or 12 tons, of its candy bars as it was leaving an Italian production site. Nestle, which distributes KitKats globally except in the United States, where Hershey has the rights, has leaned into the attention that the heist has generated. On April 1st, the company launched a stolen KitKat tracker to help recover the missing chocolates. KitKat's security escort for its delivery in Canada included a convoy of SUVs with red flags bearing the KitKat logo. The company said it also deployed guards to stand by in store displays. We are not sorry for slowing down traffic. We are actually unapologetic for getting you a KitKat delivered safely to a store near you, KitKat Canada quipped. One person who passed by the SUV convoy shared a clip of it on TikTok, where it had racked up more than 600,000 views as of April 8th. If anyone knows where they were going and if they are giving out free KitKats, please let me know, the poster said. In the video's comments, some people questioned whether it was a stunt. Others appreciated the effort. I hope the marketing team got a massive raise with this one, because it has been all over my social media for days now, one person wrote. Another said, I wonder if they have KitKat tactical gear, like it is red and white, and it says KitKat Police on the back? Nation. Pittsburgh to block police cooperation with ICE. A bill unanimously approved by the Pittsburgh City Council blocks city employees from cooperating with ICE enforcement operations, by Janine Santucci. Local leaders in Pittsburgh voted unanimously to pass an ordinance that will block police and city government employees from cooperating with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and other federal immigration agencies, the latest city to reject President Donald Trump's aggressive deportation agenda. 9 Pittsburgh City Council members on April 7th voted to pass Bill 286, and none voted against it. The bill says that no city government employees may ask about a person's immigration or citizenship status or cooperate with federal immigration agents. That includes detaining someone on the basis of the immigration status or the existence of an immigration detainer for that person, or allowing ICE agents to access a person in detention or providing information to ICE about a person's status. The vote comes just weeks ahead of the 2026 NFL draft in Pittsburgh, which is expected to draw huge crowds of fans to the city April 23rd to April 25th. The bill serves to formally codify the position taken by Pittsburgh Mayor Cory O'Connor, who has stated that city police will not cooperate with ICE, said Councilmember Barb Warwick, who introduced the bill. There are lots of people in Pittsburgh today that are terrified to take their kids to school, to get on the bus, to go to work, Warwick said during a council meeting on April 1st. It is very important that we make it clear as a city that we are a welcoming city and our public safety is here to keep people safe and not to terrorize people. The legislation also cites cooperation with the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection through local lawmakers focused largely on ICE's efforts during public meetings. Warwick acknowledged that the City Council cannot do anything about ICE's presence in the city, but said it is important to make it clear we are not going to participate in any way, and that the residents can feel safe calling 911 or other area services without fear over the immigration status. I wish this was a bill that was strong enough to tell ICE they cannot be here. That is not something we have the power to do, Councilperson Bob Charland, a co-sponsor of the bill, said. We are looking for the things we can do. The bill will be sent for approval to O'Connor, whose office did not immediately respond to a request for comment. A spokesperson told Pittsburgh's public source that O'Connor plans to sign it. DHS did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Pittsburgh has not been a city recognized by the Trump administration as a so-called sanctuary jurisdiction, from which the president has threatened to withhold federal funds. Philadelphia does make the list, along with Los Angeles, New York City, and others. There is no set definition for sanctuary cities, but the administration said factors include failing to collaborate with ICE agents, providing government benefits to undocumented immigrants, or refusing to share immigration information about jail detainees. CBS affiliate KDKA found in an analysis released this week that ICE arrests in the Pittsburgh area have surged since Trump took office for his second term. The outlet found that there were 448 such arrests in the final year of former President Joe Biden's administration, and 1,425 in the first year of Trump's second term in 2025. In January and February of 2026, there were 358 arrests, the station found. Politics. What does Trump have to do with Taco Tuesday? Social Jabs Explained, by Kinsey Crowley. President Donald Trump again delayed the consequences for his latest threat against Iran, leading critics to say taco. Trump set the April 7th deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz in an expletive-filled post on Easter Sunday. He ramped up the threat to attack the country's power plants and bridges on the morning of the deadline, saying, "A whole civilization will die tonight." But just hours before the deadline, Trump said he had reached a two-week ceasefire with Iran. "The reason for doing so is that we have already met and exceeded all military objectives, and are very far along with a definitive agreement concerning long-term peace with Iran and peace in the Middle East," Trump said on Truth Social. This is the fourth time he has pushed off his threat to attack the critical infrastructure in Iran. It's leading to an often used critique of Trump, taco. But what does it mean? Financial Times columnist Robert Armstrong coined taco trade in May 2025, describing how some investors anticipate market rebounds amid Trump's on-again, off-again tariff policies. The acronym TACO stands for Trump Always Chickens Out. Armstrong describes taco trade as some investors' strategy to buy into the market that dips when Trump announces steep tariffs on the assumption that he will back off his tariff order and the market will rebound. Trump previously hit back at a reporter who asked about the term, saying, "You ask a nasty question like that, it's called negotiation." The Supreme Court ruled on February 20th that many of Trump's tariffs were illegal. Trump announced a two-week ceasefire with Iran about 90 minutes before the deadline he had set for Power Plant Day and Bridge Day. Pakistan brokered the deal, and both Iran and the U.S. have claimed victory. The threat was a push to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, a waterway that connects the Persian Gulf with the Gulf of Oman and the Arabian Sea. It is a choke point for about 20% of the world's oil shipments and has been largely closed since the U.S. started the war in Iran, impacting the global oil market and raising prices. The ultimatum was first issued in March with a 48-hour deadline, but as it approached, he extended it for 5 days. Trump extended the deadline again later in March for 10 days, but he said that would have been inappropriate for the day after Easter, as it would have fallen on April 6th. So on Easter Sunday, April 5th, Trump issued the most recent expletive-laden deadline for 48 hours later. "Open the expletive strait, you crazy expletive, or you will be living in hell," he wrote on Truth Social on April 5th. Attacking civilian infrastructure on purpose could be a war crime, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross President Mariana Spoljarek, and echoed in a letter signed by over 100 U.S. international law experts. Donald Trump. Historians sue Trump seeking to preserve presidential records law, by Catherine Palmer. the nation's largest organization of historians and a government watchdog group, are suing President Donald Trump and his administration, hoping a judge will order them to comply with a decades-old law requiring the preservation of presidential records. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in Washington, D.C. on April 6th, challenges a recent Justice Department memorandum declaring the Presidential Records Act unconstitutional. The act, established more than 45 years ago in the wake of the Watergate crisis, demands all presidential administrations hand over their records at the end of their terms to the National Archives and Records Administration, known as the nation's record keeper, for the benefit of the American public. The American Historical Association, which says it has more than 10,000 members, and the watchdog American Oversight say in the filing that the case is about the preservation of records that document our nation's history and whether the American people are able to access and learn from that history. The lawsuit challenges an April 1st memo from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel calling the Presidential Records Act unconstitutional. T. Elliot Gaser, appointed by Trump as the office's assistant attorney general, wrote in the slip opinion that the law intrudes on the independence and autonomy of the president. Since the Nixon administration, federal law has required presidential records to be controlled by the National Archives after a president's term ends. That requirement stemmed from Nixon's attempt to destroy the White House tapes that incriminated him in the cover-up of the Watergate burglary. As of this moment, the administration believes that the president is legally free to destroy records of his official government conduct, or even spirit away the records for his own future personal use, the two groups allege in their filing challenging Gaser's memo. The DOJ declined to comment on the lawsuit. White House spokeswoman Abigail Jackson said in a statement that President Trump is committed to preserving records from his historic administration and he will maintain a rigorous records retention program. Jackson added that the president is retaining the current preservation system for electronic records, in which emails and documents cannot be deleted, and that all staff of the executive office of the president are required to take records training. Trump has run up against federal requirements for record keeping and document storage before. More than 300 classified documents were recovered from Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate more than a year after he left the White House. Most were collected under subpoena in June 2022 or during an unprecedented FBI search of the president's Florida home in August 2022. The president was indicted on 40 criminal counts in June and July of 2023 for allegedly keeping classified information and other sensitive presidential records from his first term in office in violation of the law. Most of the counts focused on allegations that Trump willfully retained national defense information. The indictment, which also alleged Trump obstructed justice by attempting to stymie the government's efforts to retrieve the documents, was dismissed in 2024. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, whom Trump nominated to the bench, wrote that the appointment of Special Counsel Jack Smith in the case was unlawful. Trump argued repeatedly that he could take records with him after leaving the White House, despite the Presidential Records Act requiring otherwise. Pope Leo XIV. Pope Leo praises Iran truce, invites world to prayer vigil in Vatican City. By Natalie Nessa Alund. Hours after President Donald Trump announced a two-week ceasefire between the United States and Iran amid global calls for diplomacy, Pope Leo XIV praised what he called a truce between the countries and invited the world to a prayer vigil set for April 11th. In the wake of these hours of great tension for the Middle East and the entire world, I welcome, with satisfaction, and as a sign of living hope, the announcement of an immediate two-week truce. The Pope, who oversees more than a billion Catholics across the globe, wrote on X the morning of April 8th. Only by returning to negotiations can the war come to an end. the American-born Pope, who has emerged as an outspoken critic of the war, asked the world to join him in this moment of delicate diplomacy with prayer, in hopes that a willingness to dialogue may become the means to resolve other conflict situations in the world as well. The Pope announced a vigil is set for 6 p.m. local time on April 11th at St. Peter's Basilica in Vatican City. In a separate earlier post, April 8th, the Pope said God can redeem all human experience. When lived in union with the passion of the Lord, even suffering can become a path to holiness, the post reads. The grace that converts and transforms life strengthens us in every trial. It does not point us toward a distant ideal, but toward the encounter with God, who became man out of love. A day earlier, the Pope called threats against the population of Iran unacceptable, in an unusual appeal hours after Trump threatened to wipe out a whole civilization if Iran did not meet the demands of the U.S. Today, as we all know, there was this threat against the entire people of Iran, and this is truly unacceptable, the Pope wrote in a post on X. Longevity rates. Tech bros like Brian Johnson skewered in new Kara Swisher CNN longevity show by David Oliver. Death comes for all of us, even the tech bros like Mark Zuckerberg and Peter Thiel. The difference? Some are spending millions of dollars trying to ward off death as long as possible, and plenty of other people purchase product after product peddled to them on social media as they embark on wellness and longevity journeys of their own. The wellness economy in the United States has ballooned to $2.1 trillion, according to the Global Wellness Institute. But are all these people's efforts in vain? What does the average person need to know to live as long and healthy a life as possible? It's a central question of veteran tech journalist Kara Swisher's new CNN series, Kara Swisher Wants to Live Forever, premiering April 11th at 9 p.m. ETPT, airing weekly, in which she tries out different wellness fads and products herself, ketamine, a hyperbaric chamber, and red light therapy to name a few, and chats with subjects like tech bros Sam Altman and Brian Johnson, scientists like Jennifer Doudna, author and journalist Amy LaRocca, and her Pivot podcast co-host and wellness enthusiast Scott Galloway. Swisher's father died of a brain aneurysm in his early 30s, fueling her interest in the subject. She also had a stroke 15 years ago. The chief takeaway: be skeptical and remember that as much as some wellness innovations sound exciting, they don't always offer as much tangible information as claimed. CRISPR gene editing, a cure for sickle cell anemia, and GLP-1s are the real innovations, not that TikTok ad for a random supplement. Plus, research shows human connection is a major pillar to living a healthy life, even if it isn't as sexy as slipping on goggles and letting red light therapy dart into your pores. She advocates for following researched, backed medical advice, like getting vaccinated against the measles, instead of fad treatments that she says are often promoted by charlatans that are promising us things they cannot deliver. Swisher visits longevity enthusiast Johnson's home in an episode of her series where he shows her how he spends $2 million a year on a longevity quest. Dozens of daily supplements, an at-home hyperbaric chamber, you name it, constantly monitoring his death. He's spending a lot on longevity and attracting wide attention for his don't die movement. There's a lot of controversy around him, she says, but I find him rather sweet in some ways, like his search for meaning, but his obsession with the measurement. Johnson sells his blueprint longevity protocols, and Swisher is always wary of someone who hands you a supplement when that person gives you a piece of advice, though she thinks Johnson means well. that says, Swisher adds, I think he's spending a lot of time doing something that he might regret later in terms of the time spent. But that's, again, his journey around the sun, so he can do it. If I were him, I'd spend more money on helping more people. But Swisher notes Johnson likely thinks that's what he's doing by gathering data about longevity. She notes most of that data is only relevant to him, so she does not believe he is truly bettering society in the way he says he is. While tech moguls like Jeff Bezos, Peter Thiel, and Mark Zuckerberg are not going so far as Johnson, Swisher questions the financial investments in anti-aging and longevity research. As much as they want to go to Mars, they are so earthbound, she says in the show. They are so desperate, clingy to hang on to life without talking about quality of life and what you do for people. Swisher questions more broadly the emphasis the wellness industry puts on measurement via wearable devices that track our diet, sleep, exercise, and the effects on our bodies. For example, when your phone or watch tells you that you have hit your 10,000 step goal, what does that actually tell you? It's meaningless numbers without an actual instruction, she says. It's just a lot of data, and I think that's confusing data with actual information. People would be better off consulting with healthcare professionals to figure out ideal goals for their respective bodies. The goal of hitting 10,000 steps a day, for example, may not actually be an accurate longevity metric. A better longevity goal is 7,500 steps, for example, research shows. Swisher, like many, has thought about how she wants to die. She'd like to be aware of what is happening. She also could not help but think of Steve Jobs, who died in 2011 and looked up at the ceiling and remarked, "Wow, oh, wow," as he died. I thought the other day, I thought I'd like to have everyone around me and look up and go, "Oh, you've got to be kidding me," and then die, she jokes. Her favorite part of being alive? Her four kids. Just having them around and thinking about their lives after me, it's just really very moving. Human connection, something you can't get from endless measurement on your own. Health and wellness. How Grey's Anatomy star juggles work and motherhood just like Dr. Joe Wilson. By Madeline Mitchell. Grey's Anatomy star Camilla Luddington knows firsthand how difficult it is to juggle work and motherhood, just like her character is learning on the show. Luddington, an English actress, is best known for her role as Dr. Jo Wilson on the medical drama series Grey's Anatomy. On the show, she plays a new mother of four, having recently adopted a daughter and welcoming a stepson before giving birth to twin girls. In reality, Luddington has two children, 9-year-old Hayden and 5-year-old Lucas. Luddington, 42, is often up and off to set before her kids are awake or comes home after her kids are already in bed, she said. She spoke with USA Today while promoting Getum's Squeezies as part of a paid partnership with Gerber. But she tries to not feel guilty for her time away from home. Her colleagues on Grey's and podcast co-host Jessica Capshaw gave her advice she will never forget. She doesn't say to her kids when she goes to work, "I am so sorry. I don't want to go to work. I want to be here," Luddington said. She actually celebrates it. She is like, "I love going to work. I'm very excited, and I'll be home soon." And so that changed mentally how I view it. She has missed recitals and questioned her ability to handle all of the ups and downs of being a working parent. "Those are the moments where I have to give myself a pep talk," she said. She likes to remind herself that she needs alone time too, and intentionally carves out time to read and stay grounded. Dr. Joe's storyline has mirrored some of Camilla Luddington's real life. If Luddington could pick one word to describe motherhood, she said, it would be messy. "I think it's just so many emotions every day all at once," she said. "And I think that Grey's does a really beautiful job of showing the highs and lows of motherhood." There have been times when her character has followed a similar journey as her in real life, in real time, she said. when Joe adopted a daughter, Ludington was having her second baby. There were episodes where I was up all night with my son and breastfeeding, and Joe was up all night. And she was tired in the episode, and I was tired in real life, she said. I love this sort of mirroring that's happened between me and Joe on the show, and her experience with motherhood, too. Ludington said she has been inspired by Joe's ability to communicate openly with her partner when she is struggling with parenting. But she said she's definitely judged Joe's parenting in other ways. I'll walk onto set, and I'm thinking, why is she still living here? Those stairs really are a hazard, Ludington said, laughing. Acting in the more traumatic or stressful parts of the show, when her character's baby is in the NICU, for example, makes her anxious about things that could go wrong with her own family, Ludington said. Those scenes were extremely intense to film, she said. When you return home, you want to hug your own babies a little bit tighter. Nation. Delivery driver admits he murdered 7-year-old, death penalty possible, by Janine Santucci. A former FedEx driver has pleaded guilty to the 2022 murder of 7-year-old Athena Strand, who was kidnapped and killed while the driver delivered a Christmas gift to her Texas home. The driver, Tanner Lynn Horner, pleaded guilty on April 7th during his murder trial, which will proceed with testimony before jurors, who will determine whether he will face life in prison or the death penalty. Horner previously told investigators that he took Athena on November 30th, 2022, after he accidentally hit her with his vehicle, so that she would not report him, though she was not seriously injured initially. He said he panicked and strangled her after she said she would tell her father he hit her. That is an absolute lie, prosecuting attorney James Stainton said in an opening statement. Stainton said the killing was planned and that Athena fought back against an hour of violence. Stainton said Horner gave multiple differing stories about what happened to Athena and where her body was during the course of a police investigation. Her body was found December 2nd, 2 days after she was reported missing by her stepmother. Stainton told jurors that Horner should have represented a modern-day Santa Claus to Athena, a strong-willed, precocious child, and was delivering what would have been Athena's Christmas gift to her home in Paradise, a town of fewer than 500 people, about 60 miles outside Dallas. Ashley Strand, her stepmother, said the package contained Barbies. He rolled up bringing what we thought would be joy and happiness in a package, Stainton said. Well, that is not what he brought that day. He brought violence, fear, and death. Stainton said inside the FedEx truck where Horner took Athena, a video camera captured some of the last moments of her life. A still image from inside the truck shows Athena kneeling, still alive and alert, behind the driver's seat. Horner told Athena, "Don't scream or I will hurt you," Stainton said the video showed. Stainton said at some point Horner covered the camera, so there is no video of him killing Athena, but there is audio that will be played in full for the jury. It's an hour. It is not 5 minutes. It's an hour. It's not just one time that he's trying to kill her. It's over and over and over again. You can hear the banging in the truck. You can hear the screams. This is what's coming. It did not happen fast, he said. Stainton said Athena fought back. She had Horner's DNA under her fingernails, and DNA was also found in places where you should not find DNA on a 7-year-old girl. She fought with the strength of 100 men, Stainton said. Athena was found naked in the Trinity River near an area called Bobo's Crossing, about 12 to 13 miles away from her home. Stainton and witness, former Wise County Sheriff Lane Aachen, said. Defense attorney Stephen Goebel said Horner suffered from mental illnesses throughout his life and is autistic. Goebel asked jurors to consider mitigating factors and sentence Horner to life in prison rather than the death penalty. Politics. DOJ says Pam Bondi no longer has to testify over Epstein files after being fired. The GOP-led House Oversight Committee said it will reach out to Bondi's personal legal representation about scheduling a deposition by Zachary Schirmel. Pam Bondi should not have to testify next week about her handling of millions of files related to the accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, a top Justice Department official argued in an April 8th letter to Congress. Assistant Attorney General Patrick Davis wrote to Representative James Comer, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, that Bondi is not bound by a subpoena anymore since she is no longer the Attorney General. The subpoena was issued after a bipartisan vote by lawmakers on the panel in early March, about a month before President Donald Trump fired Bondi on April 2nd. "We kindly ask that you confirm that the subpoena is withdrawn," Davis said. "The department remains committed to working cooperatively with the committee and continues to believe that additional compulsory process is unnecessary in light of our demonstrated willingness to voluntarily assist your oversight efforts." The letter created a cloud of uncertainty around Bondi's scheduled deposition. It also set off frustration among Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, who are clamoring for answers about why the Justice Department has not, in their view, fully complied with the Epstein Files Transparency Act. A Department of Justice with nothing to hide does not avoid a subpoena, Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina, said in a social media post. Mace was one of several GOP lawmakers who voted to compel Bondi to testify about the bungled release of the Epstein files. Officials on the GOP-led House Oversight Committee said they plan to reach out to Bondi's personal lawyers about scheduling a deposition. Representative Robert Garcia, Democrat of California, the top Democrat on the panel, and a vocal advocate for Epstein survivors, said in a statement that the subpoena still applies to Bondi, whether she is the Attorney General or not. He said he would push to hold her in contempt of Congress if she defied the order. Conviction of criminal contempt charges can come with jail time. "The survivors deserve justice," he said. Dogs. Blind Dog Rain's Journey from Shelter to Loving Home by Maria Sonnenberg. A blind dog named Rain was rescued by the nonprofit group Touch of Gray. The organization specializes in rescuing elderly or special needs dogs from shelters. Rain has been blind since birth, but with the assistance from a mobile dog gym, she can safely run without running into things. Rain's life was indeed stormy, but thanks to Touch of Gray Rescue, her life is now sunny. She came from Orange County Animal Services with a bulging eye in June of 2025. Said Touch of Gray's executive director, Misaki Robinson. She is blind and turned out to be much younger than the shelter originally presented. At the ophthalmology appointment, we learned she has oculoskeletal dysplasia, OSD, a genetic disorder, which means she has been blind since birth, Robinson said. The all-volunteer rescue group helps facilitate the removal of her bulging eye. Since she was blind since birth, Rain was never able to run free without bumping into things. Until Touch of Gray asked Jog Pup, a mobile dog gym in Florida, for help. Jog Pup is a local mobile dog gym where blind dogs can run full speed safely, Robinson said. Rain loved it. Rain was officially adopted by her foster family last Christmas. The whole family is in love with Rain, and Rain is in love with all of them. In family photos, Rain's usually not looking at the camera because, well, she cannot see the camera. Her family and pretty much anyone who meets Rain thinks it is adorable. In shelters, older or medically fragile animals like Rain are easily overlooked for younger, healthier ones. Regardless of the fact, they still have plenty of love to live happily. With shelter space at a premium, they are the first to go when decisions about euthanasia are made. Touch of Gray rescues these elderly or special needs dogs. Many, like Rain, will live out their lives under the care of Touch of Gray, kind-hearted foster parents, who open homes and hearts to them until the end. when they can, Touch of Grey works to find a good home, no matter how long it takes. Caring for an average of 40 animals at any given time requires considerable financial resources. The group spends $200,000 a year on veterinarian bills alone. Donations are always welcome, as are more foster homes. We depend on a network of foster homes, since we do not have a brick-and-mortar presence, said Robinson. U.S. Department of Justice. Is NYC a sanctuary city? What Mullen Could Do to Airport Customs, by Amethyst Martinez. U.S. airports, which have already faced intense scrutiny in recent months due to the partial government shutdown that caused extraordinarily long wait times, may undergo even more upheaval. New Homeland Security head Mark Wayne Mullen told Fox News this week that he is considering pulling Customs and Border Patrol officers out of sanctuary city airports, a move that would paralyze some of the biggest traveling hubs in the country. Some of these cities have international airports, Mullen said during the interview. If they are a sanctuary city, should they really be processing customs into their city? The DHS secretary doubled down on the threat, saying, if they're a sanctuary city and they are receiving international flights, and we're asking them to partner with us at the airport, but once they walk out of the airport, they are not going to enforce immigration policy, maybe we need to have a really hard look at that. So what is a sanctuary city and how could this affect NYC? The breadth of cities that could be affected by Mullen's policy idea spreads far. A sanctuary city is an area that limits what information is given to federal immigration officers, according to Global Refuge. Last year, the Department of Justice published a list of cities it identifies as sanctuary jurisdictions. That list includes Albuquerque, New Mexico, Berkeley, Boston, Chicago, Denver, East Lansing, Michigan, Hoboken, New Jersey, Jersey City, New Jersey, Los Angeles, New Orleans, New York City, Newark, New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Portland, Oregon, Rochester, New York, Seattle, San Francisco. Multiple cities in the NYC metropolitan region are listed, including New York City, Newark, New Jersey, Hoboken, New Jersey, and others. The government-defined list of sanctuary cities would mean LaGuardia, John F. Kennedy, and Newark Liberty airports, among others in the area, could lose CBP officers. I'm going to have to be forced to make hard decisions, Mullen said. I am not going outside the policies that Congress passed for me, and we're not trying to push those. But we're saying you've got to partner with us. Mullen said that officials may stop processing international flyers through Border Patrol at some of the largest airports in the United States if sanctuary cities did not comply. It is not immediately clear how Mullen would go about implementing the rule, or if it was a plan DHS would follow through with. I believe sanctuary cities, it's not lawful, he told Fox News. I don't think they're able to do that, and so we're going to take a hard look at this. California Governor Gavin Newsom went to X to slam the idea, which he called stupid. If you thought the economy was bad with Trump's war driving prices at the pump up, just wait until international travel is halted at some of the busiest airports in the world, his press office account posted. Talk about a stupid idea. No wonder it's being considered by the Trump admin. Nation. Jackie and Shadow's baby chicks are bonking. It is normal behavior, by Michelle Del Rey. Jackie and Shadow are now the proud parents of two eaglets after the couple's chicks hatched over the weekend. But as the adorable pair get acclimated to life in the nest, they've been observed doing some perplexing, perhaps even seemingly concerning, behavior. The siblings have been caught pecking and pushing each other during a feeding session. But the behavior, called bonking, is actually common and nothing to worry about. According to the nonprofit that monitors the eagles, friends of Big Bear Valley, sibling rivalry is typical among eaglets. The dominant chick will tend to eat first, while the smaller chick waits or comes up with creative ways to get the food, like walking around or waiting until the bigger chicks go into a food coma. Bonking usually subsides once there is a pecking order, the nonprofit wrote, meaning when the chicks determine which one will eat first. Because the birds live in a rich food environment, it is unlikely bonking will continue. The nonprofit expects the sibling rivalry to soon turn into friendship. It's thought the phase could last a few days or a week. However, the nonprofit warns that a bonked chick may lie down and assume a submissive stance with its head down in a movement similar to holding up a white flag. But the action does not mean the chick is unconscious or injured, the nonprofit said. The bonking may even serve the chicks as they grow. Once they fledge the nest, the aggressiveness may do them well, the nonprofit said. Chick 1 and Chick 2 hatched on April 4th at 9:33 p.m. and April 5th at 8:30 a.m., respectively. The eagle family lives in a nest in Big Bear Valley, a 15-mile valley in the San Bernardino National Forest in Southern California. The chicks are about 4 to 5 inches tall, the nonprofit said in a Facebook post. They're eating often. On Wednesday, April 8th, the nonprofit said the chicks were fed 17 times in one day. The live feed for the majestic birds can be viewed on the Friends of Big Bear Valley website. Crime. Rex Huerman admits to gruesome Gilgo Beach serial killings, by India Yancey Bragg. The man accused of being a serial killer who targeted women on Long Island over the course of nearly two decades admitted to 8 killings on April 8th. New York architect Rex Huerman, 62, was arrested in 2023 in connection with the Gilgo Beach murders, a case that had long stumped investigators and became the subject of a 2020 Netflix film. Multiple sets of human remains were found in the area in 2010 and 2011, leading investigators to suspect a serial killer was responsible for the deaths. Officials said a key break in the case came more than a decade later when they matched DNA from a pizza Huerman ate to a male hair found with the remains. Huerman initially pleaded not guilty to the murders of 7 women whose remains were found in the area between 1993 and 2011. He pleaded guilty on April 8th and admitted to killing an 8th victim, according to a release from the district attorney's office. The calm, serene, almost grandfatherly image Rex Huerman portrayed since his arrest was a lie and, quite frankly, an insult to law enforcement, but more importantly, the families that had to endure that during every court appearance over the last 2.5 years, said Suffolk Police Commissioner Kevin Catalina. Today he was exposed for exactly what he is, a sadistic, soulless, murderous monster, and thankfully, everybody today got to see that. Huerman will be sentenced on June 17th, according to a release from the district attorney's office. He is expected to face 3 consecutive sentences of life without the possibility of parole and a consecutive sentence of 100 years to life imprisonment. Gloria Allred, an attorney who represents some of the victims' family members, said last week that they had to decide whether they preferred to accept Huerman's guilty plea or go to trial. Relatives of 4 victims spoke briefly and said they accept the plea. Finally, a sense of relief, said Melissa Kahn, sister of Maureen Brainerd Barnes. The guilty plea brings solace, and I'd like to thank everyone that had a part in that fight for justice. Allred said some of the victims were young mothers who turned to sex work to earn money to support their families. Some just wanted to survive in this difficult and challenging world, she said. Meanwhile, Huerman believed he had a perfect plan to kill and avoid detection, Allred said. But the families of his victims refused to give up until their loved one's killer was caught. It was bittersweet for them to be in court and hear the defendant plead guilty to the murder of their loved one, and the manner of their death, Allred said, but the truth was important to them, and they heard it today. Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney said the case was a painful scar on the county, but he disputed the notion that no one cared about these victims, as he detailed the multi-state and multi-agency effort to solve this case. He said a massive task force worked quietly to solve the murders. Tierney said law enforcement wanted to lull Huerman into a false sense of security so that they could collect crucial evidence when they finally executed the search warrants. How we envisioned it happening, that is what happened, he said. Family members of the victims were also integral to the investigation, he said. He individually expressed condolences to and gratefulness for them, recalling one relative who was particularly rattled by having to relive difficult memories during the grand jury proceedings. We're sorry for that, but without their cooperation, we wouldn't be here today, he said. Huerman's wife, attorney, speak after guilty plea. Outside the courthouse, an attorney told reporters Asa Alarup never wanted to believe her husband Huerman was capable of these crimes, but she and his daughter accept today's outcome without question. My thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families. Their loss is immeasurable, and the focus should be on them at this time and moment, said Alarup, who was married to Huerman for 27 years. I ask that you give some privacy to my family as they navigate through this very difficult time. Huerman's attorney told reporters he could not specify when his client decided to plead guilty and admit to the killings. But Michael J. Brown acknowledged that the prosecution scored some big wins in court and investigators did a great job gathering a huge volume of evidence. Although the defense team was prepared to go to trial, Brown said Huerman wanted to save his family and the families of his victims from the ordeal. Brown also said he believes admitting guilt provided a sense of relief for Huerman. Yeah, I think by admitting it, I think it's cathartic to some extent, he said. Is he sorry? A reporter asked. I would hope so, Brown said. As part of the plea, Brown said Huerman has agreed to cooperate with the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Behavioral Analysis Unit. He said Huerman is maintaining that he has no other victims. The earliest murder Huerman was charged with dates back to the 1990s, according to a release from the District Attorney's Office that lays out the timeline. Prosecutors say Huerman strangled Sandra Costella, 28, to death in November 1993 and left her body in the North Sea on Long Island, where it was quickly discovered by hunters. In April 1996, he killed and dismembered Karen Vergata, 34, whose partial remains were found on Blue Point Beach in the town of Brookhaven that same month, the release said. In late 2000, he killed Valerie Mack, 24, and part of her body was found by hunters in Manorville, about 40 miles east of Gilgo Beach. Mack was not identified until 2020. Part of Jessica Taylor's body was also found in Manorville in July 2003. Prosecutors say Huerman strangled her to death and left her remains there. In July 2007, Huerman used a burner phone to arrange a meeting with Maureen Brainard Barnes, 25, and killed her. Prosecutors say he did the same to Melissa Barthelemy, 24, Megan Waterman, 22, and Amber Costello, 27, in 2009 and 2010. The investigation ramped up when law enforcement discovered the remains during a training exercise along a Gilgo Beach roadway in 2010. In December 2010, police found the bodies of the women known as the Gilgo Four, Barthelemy, Waterman, Costello, and Brainard Barnes. The women were all believed to be sex workers at the time of their disappearances, according to court records. As investigators continued to search the area where the Gilgo Four were found, more remains from Huerman's earlier victims were found. Taylor's skull, hands, and forearm were discovered there in March 2011. On April 4, 2011, investigators found Mack's partial remains along Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach. That same month, investigators found some of Virgata's remains near Tube Beach. Tube Beach is located about 2 miles away from Gilgo Beach. Before her identification in 2023, Virgata was referred to as Fire Island Jane Doe. Huerman admitted to, but was not charged with, Virgata's death. Other remains have been found and identified in the area, but Huerman has not been charged in those deaths. The discovery of the Gilgo 4 came around the time police were searching for Shannon Gilbert, a 24-year-old sex worker who vanished after leaving a client's house in Oak Beach. This case closes and another one opens, Tierney said. There are still bodies on that beach. There are still bodies in Suffolk County. There's no rest for the weary. Huerman, owner and founder of a Manhattan architecture firm, was connected with the Gilgo Beach case in early 2022, when investigators linked him to a Chevrolet Avalanche pickup truck that a witness reported seeing in 2010. Investigators found connections between Huerman and the murders in phone and bank records and began surveilling him. In January 2023, police sent a pizza crust thrown out by Huerman to a forensic lab for analysis. Months later, the lab reported a swab from the crust matched a hair found where the women's bodies were discovered. Prosecutors later confirmed that a court-ordered swab taken directly from Huerman's mouth matched the DNA from the pizza. He was arrested outside his Manhattan office in July 2023 and initially charged with the murders of Waterman, Bartholomew, and Costello. In 2024, he was charged with the murders of Brainard Barnes in January, Taylor and Costello in June, and Mack in December. He was expected to stand trial in September. This concludes the presentation of USA Today for Thursday, April 9th, 2026. My name is Elizabeth Ingber with the Talking Information Center. As always, thank you.